Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of Sci-Fi on Screen. Today's episode, we're going to be looking at 1968 film Planet of the Apes. Let's get right to it. First, a little background on Apes. Apes was based on a novel published by Pierre Boulle in France in 1963. The American-English version was published in June 1963. And the story is a bit different. There are a lot of similarities between the book and the film. I would urge any who are interested to head on over to Wikipedia. There is a detailed synopsis of the novel, and one can read through it and see the parallels with the film. Rod Serling took a first pass at the book, and he wrote a first draft. His version included modern-day ape society, which was very similar to the novel, but was deemed too expensive to film because of that by the powers that be. So they turned to a blacklisted writer named Michael Wilson, who actually wrote some amazing films. You can look him up as well. I think there's a lot of films he was uncredited for, I think because he was blacklisted, but it looks like he took a pass at Bridge on the River Kwai, Lawrence of Arabia, so an amazing writer on his own right. So he was brought in to rewrite, and ultimately the settings were changed to the lower-tech ape city that we see in the film. But most of the plot was the same. They kept Serling's ending, because that was all Rod, and, you know, partially the book. But film ending was very much Rod Serling's creation. What's told is that Wilson rewrote much of the dialogue, but in this film I would like to think that his spirit informs a great deal of the script. Serling, I'm talking about. We're told that an unknown writer came in to do like a last-minute polish, and then they had a filming script. A bit about Franklin Schaffner, the director. This is sort of his first big hit. He had directed some westerns, one with Heston called The Warlord. And after this film, he went on to do Patton, which was a huge hit for him, Papillon, and Nicholas Alexandra. So he went on and did some amazing films after Apes. So before I get into the film, part of my desire to do Apes early on in my podcast is because Apes has fallen into this strange pop culture place. There are definitely those out there, who I am one of them, who revere the film in terms of the themes that it deals with, the incredible ending, and so many other things. But because of Heston's acting, and I'll get into that more as the podcast goes on, Apes also has become sort of a pop culture cliche. Some of the big lines in the film have become pop cultural icons in their own right. I think a lot of times, you know, younger viewers possibly as well, and people who haven't maybe seen the film or haven't seen it for a while, that Apes is thought of as sort of a goofy movie, that it's preposterous, that it's overacted, and that these lines are indicative of just a real goofy movie. I really don't agree with that assessment of it. I think Apes was deadly serious from the get-go. I think Serling's script and Wilson's script and Schaffner's direction and even the acting, and I'll get into that more and more, where the lines are drawn in terms of what some people may think of as camp and what I think of as earnest acting or an incredible situation. How would a human being act in that situation? So that's partly why I want to do this. I hope that I succeed in maybe pulling some viewers towards this film again in a different way than maybe they've been in the past. So with that little caveat, let's get going. So the film opens on Charlton Heston sitting in a pilot's seat of what looks like a spacecraft. The camera's a little bit back behind him, and we see these four sleep chambers, which us hip sci-fi viewers of the future now recognize as sort of hibernation pods. Three of them are occupied. He's sort of narrating some last log before, he goes to sleep. We see these really cool effects out the window. They're like colored lens flares. We don't see any stars. For me, I think this is a really neat effect. You know, us looking out the front of this spacecraft, and we see these colored lens flares, and that's it. You know, there's not the classic starry backdrop that we've become so used to seeing in science fiction films. So I just find that very interesting and unique. We are listening to Heston talk about 6 months out of Canaveral, and we see on the dashboard of the ship that the ship time is July 14th, 1972. The time on Earth they've left behind is March 24th, 2673. So already they're 700 years in the future before anything even happens in this movie. And what I like is that the hinge to this entire film's plot is laid out right at the gate. A quick word about relativity, because it's going to play a large part in how this film works. I mean, this film is based around a real scientific concept. I'm sure most people listening to this podcast are well acquainted with relativity. But in a nutshell, they're part of the relativity's theoretical effects. When an object acquires a greater mass, or when an object moves faster through space, time for that object passes much slower than time on objects that are of lesser mass or moving slower. So an experiment was done in 1971 where they took two atomic clocks and they flew them around the Earth in these airliners. What they knew was going to happen, or what they the theory predicted, was because the clocks were further up from the Earth, they were going to run faster, since those closer to the Earth, closer to higher gravity, higher mass, time would run slower. At the same time, the clocks were flying pretty quickly, and the velocity would also make them run faster. So they calculated the difference between the two effects, and in fact, when the clocks came back and compared to the original clock, the results bared out Einstein's theory. So even in a very minuscule way, relativity has been pretty well proven theoretically. So that's the hinge on which this movie goes, that obviously they keep talking about a Dr. Haslein rather than Einstein. Haslein's theory, and it's basically Einstein's theory of relativity. So we have to come to believe now that for 6 months, the crew on the ship has been accelerating up to near the speed of light. So time on Earth has been accelerating, and time for them is much slower. Now, a bit about Heston's monologue. It's a nice monologue. Sets up the early theme in the movie by near the end of his speech saying, "You who are reading me now are of a different breed, I hope a better one." And this is obviously a little foreshadowing of the breed that actually has succeeded mankind on the planet. Is it a better one? You know, we don't know yet, but a little illusion, as it were. And he talks about being out in space, how it squashes a man's ego and makes him feel lonely. I like that. I like a science fiction film in the first 5 minutes. You have a character talking about how lonely he feels out in space, being so far away from home. To me, that's why I think this film still resonates, because what it's getting at underneath all of the surface details is, you know, these are deep details that the film is playing with, and I think to its credit. And then there's a wonderful quote that he ends it, and he says, quote, "Tell me, though, does man, that marvel of the universe, that glorious paradox who sent me to the stars, still make war against his brother, keep his neighbor's children starving?" So already, Taylor has this knowledge of his species and who he is, where he comes from. This will be bookended marvelously with a line from the end of the film given by Dr. Zaius, which we will eventually get to. Taylor beds down, and we are given the credit sequence. It's a very quiet opening with this wonderful score. This Jerry Goldsmith score for this film is just marvelous. It's a strange score. There are plucked piano strings and percussion and these trash can sounding Chinese cymbals and these angular sort of atonal piano lines, these bass piano lines, and you hear flutes and echoes of plucked strings, and it's an amazing soundtrack. And so the credits, very quiet opening credits. A lot of this, the music he's using is very sparse. And you're really given a sense of kind of wonder and awe in the beginning of this film. You're given a setup, and then you're allowed to kind of sit with that setup as the music kind of pans in and you go through the credits. Then suddenly the camera is wheeling and whirling above like a desertscape. You get a sense that the camera is sort of affixed to the front of the spacecraft because we're moving through these canyons and over and under these hills. And finally, the camera follows us down and we crash into this lake. And then the camera backs off, and now we're seeing through the windows of the spacecraft inside the desert and the outside as the ship bobs up and down. It's a really cool effect. The astronauts now are all awakened. They get up and one of them jumps down, and they get, and the three men awake, and they go to look at Stewart, who is the lone female occupant, and they find out that she has died in hypersleep. And so what you see is this ancient woman's desiccated, sort of shriveled corpse. The first instance of this effect that director Shaffner will use, where he zooms in to a specific detail, and you know, we zoom into her face and how hard it is that she has died. And we see that there is a huge crack in the glass that covered her sleep chamber. And then obviously it had malfunctioned. And over these decades, she has just, you know, died of old age. Then to action. The ship seals give way, and all of a sudden, Stillwater starts roaring in. So the camera cuts up to this wide shot and sort of swings all around and outside the capsule, and it's amazing. And it looks, you know, you're seeing this desert. I mean, I'm sure it was out in Death Valley somewhere, but it looks wonderfully real. Like, they are on a real place. This isn't some fake sci-fi planet. It's very realistic and lots of lens flares. As the ship is sinking, some good SF comes into play here as Taylor instructs Dodge to read the atmosphere. This is good because, you know, most sci-fi films, you go down on planets, most of them have air, you know, and in space and real science, you know, it's a very rare thing to have a planet with the kind of oxygen-nitrogen mix that we have. So we see this device sort of extend from the ship, which is like, you know, a little device to sense the air. And then we see Landon crawl up this little catwalk and supposedly look at the atmospheric reading device, but it's basically a red and a green light and a rotating barbershop pole inside. It's terrible, but I have to give them the benefit of the doubt. They went for it, and maybe that thing in 1968 looked very futuristic. So they find out that the atmosphere is fine, and they blow the hatch. But before they leave, Taylor has a last look at the Earth time chronometer. And now he sees that the date is November the 25th, 3978. So from when we first were with them earlier on, pre-credits, they were 700 years in the future. Now they're 1,300 years further, making them 2,000 years into Earth's future. So their time was so slow, Earth has aged 2,000 years since they're gone. And of course, first time viewers to the movie, we don't know if this is Earth. We just know that on Earth, it's 2,000 years have passed. There's some nice wide shots of the men paddling away in a yellow life raft as the ship sinks. Then they continue to paddle on through this wonderful canyon. It's beautiful canyon. This very narrow river with these very high sides. And right away, man, you're in the setting. I mean, this is a real place. This is no green screen. They're really rooting you in the fact that they are in a place. So eventually they land and they take stock of their provisions. They find out that they have 3 days of food and water. And Taylor finally lets them in on the time readings, letting them know what he's seen as he left the ship. And basically he's pushing on this guy, Landon, and we have no idea why. But he's pushing him like, time's wiped out everything you ever knew. And Landon is kind of pushing back at him like, hey, until you can prove it, it's still just a theory. Again, foreshadowing the end of the film when it's proved pretty much beyond a shadow of a doubt that it is, in fact, real. So they take soil samples, and they talk about nitrogen locked in the nitrates, which, you know, I'd have to talk to a biologist or a geologist, see if sounds real. Sounds like they're talking science, but they have 3 days to find food and water. As they walk away from the campsite they had made, Landon has taken a tiny American flag, and he's stuck it in the rock, and he put some rocks around it. And Schaffner zooms in on it with that famous shot of his that he always uses in this film. And Taylor laughs and laughs and laughs very cynically. It's a great moment. Like, someone like Landon is still holding on to such things as nationalism when, in Taylor's mind, 2,000 years have passed. If there's anything even remotely connected to the United States of America, it would be such a long shot that is, in fact, a big joke. So they start their trek through this rocky desert. And it's beautifully shot. There are long scenic vistas, and there are long shots where, you know, you're really just seeing landscape and the three tiny men walking along sort of a rocky outcropping. Lots of lens flare. I wonder how much J.J. Abrams watched this movie. I see the amount of lens flare in it. And rocky outcroppings and Goldsmith's wonderful score. They take their time. It's a very quiet film as it opens. It's eerie. It's, you don't know where you are or what's going on. And the director and the writer kind of let you sit there and sort of soak in the eerie desolation of where these guys are. We're not thrown huge drama right away. They're explorers and they're doing their thing and we're seeing where they are. And I think that when directors take their time to really put you in a place, there's a subliminal effect that happens that maybe you don't know, that you're not conscious of as a viewer, that grounds the film in a way that if you're rushing past the scene or the setting and you're not giving your audience time to kind of settle in, that it's going to be harder to grab them going down the road. Obviously, I can't prove that, but I know that films that take their time to open, if I'm not in a rush and I can go with them, I seem to tend to just be rooted in those films later on. You know, there's more at stake for some reason, and I can never really figure it out. But one of my theories is that taking your time with opening up a film and setting the stage in a real granite way really helps things. And anyway, I think it really helps here as well. Now, truth be told, the two obstacles of their trek are kind of ridiculous. There's one where the three of them have to kind of scooch down the side of a large hill. And, you know, the music makes it seem like they're falling off Everest, and it just seems like they're sledding. It's kind of goofy. And then there's one where evading one large, semi-large boulder, like, has them completely exhausted. So some of the things they have to go through on this trek are kind of ill-conceived and definitely very dated. There are some cool effects, though, and there's some new things where at night there's this thunder and lightning, and the sky sort of flashes in these really wild violet and green colors. So it's the first sense that something is a little out of place in this world. And the three astronauts also can't make heads or tails of it either, but it's a nice touch. So as they're walking, Taylor somehow continues to ride hard on Landon. He's saying, this is where you are, and you know, for whatever reason, he continually tells him, everyone you've loved is gone for 20 centuries. Like, you know, it's like, dude, easy. The guy's just waking up from this incredible situation. One little funny line where Heston tells Landon, well, if you actually did make it back by now, you know, they'd feel like you'd fallen out of a tree. So again, another little allusion to what's to come. And then there's a very pat bit of very old stock dialogue where Taylor basically is like, let me tell you, Landon, who you are. You were the All-American boy and signed on for this trip of glory and blah, blah, blah. And you wanted immortality and heroism and look what you found. So for whatever reason, it's a goofy, like, 1950s kind of, like, you know, the All-American boy, really. And it's too pat because Landon basically is like, well, yeah, you read me right, Taylor, you know, but why can't I read you? Landon gets back to Taylor by basically saying, you know, you're different. You're a complete negative. And that he thought life on Earth was meaningless and that he despised people. So you get a bit of kind of who Taylor was or is, exactly. Taylor kind of says his purpose for being out in space is that there must be something better out there and that he's looking for it. So obviously setting you up for what's to come, which I think is great. So they discover a lone plant. It's this little plant in the desert. Beautiful evening shots of the desert landscape. It's also some lens flare. So they wind up following another plant and another, sort of continuing on, thinking that they're, you know, on their way to follow, finding more life. And suddenly during a trek through this like rocky area, the camera sort of low angle, and we see high up on some cliffs nearby, these little human figures running. So immediately it's our first sense of there are other people on this planet. Besides them, they kind of look human. We're not really sure if they are or not. Basically, they're figures. And then we continue to see them up at the top of the cliffs here and there, watching the three astronauts. They enter some scrublands, and they see off in the distance these sort of ape scarecrows. The ape scarecrows are these large X's covered with gorilla hide and fur. And they look cool, man. They look the Jerry Goldsmith score, getting you with its creepiness. You see these incredibly cool large X's. It's eerie and neat. I think it's a great effect. And so they finally push past the scarecrows and they find a waterfall and a pool of fresh water and some vegetation. They take off all their clothes and dive in, splash around for a while, and then one of them finds a footprint in a sort of the soft earth near the pool. Then we see that these figures that we had seen before have taken all of their clothes and supplies and headed off into the jungle. So the three astronauts follow them, and as they're chasing them, they're realizing that they're shredding their clothing and smashing all their equipment. And by the time it's over, they come out of the jungle into this beautiful sort of pastoral landscape, and the humans are just there, taking corn, going up into trees, and throwing down fruit. There's this wonderful Eden that they've discovered. I think Landon makes some remark about them, and Heston has this great line. He's like, if this is the best they've got, in 6 months we'll be running this planet. And that moment, the apes attack. And obviously, now we don't know the apes attack. And I think the way the apes are revealed here is such a great moment. First, they hear something out in the distance. There's a long silence. And then all of a sudden, the humans are running. And the three astronauts kind of follow along. They're running into the corn. And then suddenly, we see rising up above the corn these beating sticks. And so obviously, they can't go the way of the beating sticks. So they all turn around and run. And then all of a sudden, we see horses are arriving, and then a horse goes by Taylor and turns around, and the camera zooms in, and it's the face of an ape in a uniform riding the horse. And then we immediately get Taylor's reaction shot, and it's amazing. I think it's a great reveal. We've been in this film for like 25, 30 minutes, and now we've just seen an ape. And I think the decision to do it that way is key because you've been built up, and now, boom, it's right there. And smartly, you can't linger on it because our protagonists are in trouble. There's danger to run from, and of course, they do. We see all the beating sticks kind of emerge, and of course, they're being held by apes. Everyone runs willy-nilly. Taylor ends up leading his apes on a chase. So they're running around. Landon is caught. Dodge is actually shot and killed. And then Taylor is shot in the neck, which is, again, a brilliant setup for the next part of the film. And then there's a really cool scene. It's just after the hunt. Again, it's dead quiet. There's no dialogue. And it's just like a quiet scene of the apes going about their business after the hunt. Humans are stacked in a pile. Some dead humans are hung. The apes are kind of packing up. And then there's a bunch of apes standing in an area, and another ape with a cigar in his mouth takes a photograph. And they laugh. And there's a lot of these little neat little scenes in the movie that I think make this movie really great. We cut to Taylor in Ape City, which is kind of an odd, low-tech place. It's not quite medieval. I mean, they know how to do transfusions. Taylor is being given a transfusion of blood from a woman that he's noticed a few times during the hunt, and we will be introduced to as Nova. I'll refer to her as Nova from here on, even though in the film she's not given a name until later. And then we're introduced to Kim Hunter as Dr. Zira, who is a animal psychologist. Right away, you know, now that you're in a scene with apes, you realize that the makeup is fantastic. I have to give a shout out to this guy named John Chambers, who's the makeup artist for this film. And what's great about the makeup here is that there's very little delineation between when you see someone's eyes and the skin, as you know, and the eyes as it goes out to sort of the ape prosthetic. It's seamless. So you're getting, you know, you clearly can see the human being's eyes, which for film is so necessary. They've done it in such a way that when people speak underneath these masks, the mouths move as well. So you're not getting these dead masks. It's very lifelike. I think from what I've seen, I remember seeing the documentary. There's a documentary out called Behind the Planet of the Apes, and obviously it goes into all five of the original movies and gets into the makeup and everything. They had to enunciate their words when they spoke kind of more than normal to get their lips to move for the prosthetic masks. But they did it really well. You know, the great thing about the makeup is that these characters emerge rather quickly. You know, Zira is a tremendously intelligent woman with bright, quick eyes, and you're in. Like, she's immediately a believable character. And being a female character, she's given intelligence. She's an animal psychologist. She's smart. She's funny. Like, she's an amazing character. Kind that you don't really see in a lot of sci-fi films very often. Now, one thing that has to be said here, the huge leap of faith you have to make as a viewer in this film is that the apes speak English and that Taylor can understand them. So the fact that this wouldn't have clued Taylor in early on in the movie that he was back on Earth, you're gone from Earth for how many thousands of years and you come back and you land on what you think is an alien planet, because they think they're on another planet. They don't think they're on Earth. And the twist in this whole film, they talk about that earlier on where they believe they're certain light years from home in a certain galaxy. The fact that, you know, they all speak English, criticize it at your leisure because it is a real criticism. I easily these days just go with it. And we get a sense now of how ape societies are organized. You have sort of the aggressive guerrillas are the military. The orangutans are kind of like the conservative, like administrators and leaders. And the chimpanzees are kind of like the liberal scientists and thinkers. There's definitely a pecking order, and you can see it. And they also dress very much in different. The orangutans dress in sort of orange clothing. The gorillas in black. The chimpanzees in green. So they're immediately distinguishable. It's a nice touch where they could have all just been apes, but the fact that they've delineated the society into three classes already, with the humans as sort of, you know, animal slave labor and experimental, you know, animals as well. It's a great touch. So the humans are kept in like a zoo-like place where they're hosed down. They really do live like animals. Zira comes to visit Taylor because Taylor makes this motion of wanting to speak, but obviously his neck wound is preventing him, and it's kind of pricked her interest. So she comes to visit him, and soon after Dr. Zaius comes to visit him, and we are greeted by the wonderful Maurice Evans, who is sort of the antagonist in this film, if you can call him that, and who, again, like Roddy McDowall to come and Kim Hunter, amazing, really in the character, very commanding. So you're getting a sense from this byplay that Zaius is not really fond of the work that Zira is doing, and that it's preposterous that apes could learn anything about themselves by studying human beings. Already, you've got like a scientific kind of faith-based rubbing of elbows here in this film. And then we have this really nice meet-cute scene between Cornelius and Zira where they meet and they look around to see if anyone's looking, and they give each other like a little kiss, and just the physicality of how they are both inhabiting these characters. And Dowell is fantastic in this, equal to Kim Hunter easily. It's a very cute scene. Taylor is now being held outside in some outside cage for the day. They're gathered around. Basically, Zero wants Cornelius to see him, and Taylor starts to write a word in the ground with a stick. They all turn around because Zaius has arrived, and then Nova, afraid that he's done something, really bad, starts to knock out the words, and some other human being sees it and starts to knock the words out with their feet. And suddenly Taylor's fighting this other human, these two men. It's a brief fist fight where you get a sense that the guy that Taylor's fighting is just an animal. Like he's fighting like an ape, and Taylor has some martial training. It's interesting to see it. And Taylor, of course, wins the fight. Taylor's taken away, and then they all leave. And then Zaius walks over, and there's a little bit of the writing left. And Zaius sees it, and he scratches it out with his stick. And so we're given a brief, mystery now. What does he know, and what does he think of all this? Zero comes back to visit Taylor. There's a brief scuffle where Taylor grabs that Zero. The guard thinks that Taylor is attacking her, but in fact, he's stealing her pad and pencil, winds up writing his name. And of course, a great moment when she gets it back and she sees the paper and it's written, "My name is Taylor." And so Taylor's taken back to her office. Then we cut back. They've obviously been in the office for like an hour. There's dozens and dozens of messages written all over the table. And Zero and Cornelius are questioning Taylor, and he's writing answers. And Cornelius just seems like he's not buying any of it. Zero is trying to tell him he's reasoning. Why don't you want to believe any of this? And Cornelius is very much like not having it. Taylor asks them to show him a map. So he describes the map is really cool too. He describes where the ship crash landed and where they came from. And of course, Cornelius is like, you could never have been gotten through the Forbidden Zone. They talk about flying. The flight is a physical impossibility. And in a genius moment of the script, Taylor makes a paper airplane and throws it. And there's like a shocking moment of silence where they all look at it. It's a really neat moment. And then, of course, there's this notion of heresy that Cornelius has to be careful in what he says, because there's the notion of what they call scientific heresy. And you get a sense that he's messing around with evolution. That he's trying to purport that, apes may have evolved from human beings, but it is such a dangerous notion. Zero's kind of pushing him and saying they'll have to accept it, and he's like, no, they won't. And so it's a nice conflict, that these two really smart individuals are having to navigate the waters of their faith and their culture. And then, of course, Zaius arrives, and there's a bit there. Everyone's barking at everyone, and they see Taylor. They take him away, and Zaius picks up the airplane. He's like, what is this? And Zero says it's a toy that floats on the air. And Zaius, of course, says nonsense, and he crushes it. And he knows something. So back in Taylor's cell, he overhears some guards talking that he's about to be sterilized on Zaius's order. So right away, that Zaius knows something. Taylor gets away, and there's this long chase through the city where Taylor's just basically running in circles. Where the hell is he going to go? He doesn't know where he's going. And he stumbles into this funeral, which is kind of interesting, and you hear one of the ape ministers talking about heaven, and there's some toss-off to the apes have a religion here. There's a goofy line where supposedly this line was written by like the guy who made the third pass on the script, where the minister is talking about the deceased, and he's like, he always said, I never met an ape I didn't like. Ha, ha, ha. Taylor keeps running. Someone stumbles onto him, and he ends up in a museum. It quiets down. There's a lull in the chase. Taylor sees Dodge, and he thinks it's Dodge, and he gets up to him, and Dodge's eyes are white, and he's been stuffed. He's dead, and he's been stuffed at the museum. And so they finally catch him, get him in the net, and he gets to utter, the first of these immortal lines, "Get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape." And the soundtrack comes down, and the entire ape city basically freezes in silence. It's still a cool notion. It's, you can see the film 1,000 times, but the simple conflict that the apes don't believe that humans can talk and that Taylor can talk, it's only a matter of time when he does. And it's just a great tension to me, and it's a great release of tension when it actually happens. Then it's been a while, and Taylor's sort of now speaking all the time in his cell. And he's having this little monologue with Nova. And the guards come in and they remove her, I guess, because they didn't want them to breed. Julius, his ape keeper, comes in with a fire hose and sprays him. And at the end of it, another one of the famous lines, "It's a madhouse, a madhouse." And then afterwards, there's this nice moment where he's talking to himself and kind of to Nova, where he's telling her, about the world he came from. He has these great lines, where one of them was that there was lots of lovemaking, but no love. That was the kind of world we made. Just a really great line, you know. At the end of it, you know, he's referencing when Stuart, the astronaut who came with him and the others, he says, "You're not as smart as Stuart, but you're the only girl in town." It's kind of a funny line. So now there's this show trial that gets set up, and made me think of the Scopes monkey trial that happened early in the 20th century on similar themes. So I'm sure that there was some notion as to this. But he, again, here's another one of those moments in the script where Taylor gets taken to the courthouse early, and he's standing there. No one else is there, and it's quiet, and he's just standing there. And suddenly someone comes in and puts some papers out. And then another ape comes in and puts out scrolls. And it's like 30 to 40 seconds of silence before anything happens. And it's just, it's a nice breath before, you know, things are about to happen. So basically, the trial is sort of a trial about heresy. There's some early byplay where, you know, since Taylor is a man, he has no rights under ape law. So Taylor writes a little speech and he gives it to Cornelius, who gives it to one of the judges, and they start to read it. And it's about, you know, coming from a ship in the sky, another solar system, and you know, they think it's a joke, of course. Then Cornelius and Zira, you know, ask the prosecutor, "Well, why can't you let him speak for himself?" And the prosecutor's like, "Please, let me grant them this joke." And he asks them all these questions about ape theology, obviously, which Taylor is ignorant. What does the third scroll say? And of course, because he doesn't know all this, he cannot think, which is there. I mean, it's brilliant. They talk about the other people that he was with, and he said there were some other humans captured in the hunt. So they bring Taylor outside. They gather all the humans that were with him when they were first discovered. And he sees Landon off in the distance, and he asks if he could go and speak to them. And he walks over, and he's like, Landon. And we get the great Schaffner zoom in, and Landon turns a little bit to the right, and you see this large swath of hair has been shaved off his head, and there's like a flap of skin, and you know that he's been lobotomized. It's a great scene, man, and Heston's rage. You see that Cornelius and Zira are embarrassed, like they're ashamed because they didn't know about it. And Taylor looks at Zaius and he's like, "You did this, you!" And he's completely enraged and rushes Zaius, and they grab him. But it's a great little scene, man. You know, it's very well played. So then the last part of the hearing, Zira is given a chance to speak. And her basic thesis is like, you know, she can find no evidence of why human beings can't speak. They possess all the parts. And she theorizes also that since Taylor hasn't come from another planet, he must be from theirs. And it's all heresy, you know. And as she's saying this, there's a widescreen shot of the three judges. And the more she speaks, the one judge covers his eyes, the other judge covers his ears, and Zaius covers his mouth. And it's basically a see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil kind of little joke, in-joke in the movie. And it's fun. You know, I didn't pick it up until, you know, I'd seen it many times and someone had to kind of clue me in on it. But once that speech is done, Cornelius basically comes out and states that he thinks that apes have evolved from a lower form of primate. And he's immediately like, "That's heresy." And they end the hearing with judgment to be rendered, you know, soon. And then Taylor is brought to Zaius's sort of office. And Zaius kind of drops all pretense, man. He kind of is talking to Taylor as an equal, and he basically puts it to him. He's like, "Look, you're going to be sterilized, and I'm going to operate on you and do brain surgery, and you'll end up with a living, walking death, unless you tell me where your nest is and your women." Because he doesn't really believe the astronaut theory either, but he knows something. Zaius kind of asserts that Taylor is a mutant, and Taylor goes, "You know that's heresy?" And Zaylo's like, "Yeah, it is heresy." But Zaius is not some faith-based sort of dullard. He is a sharp cookie, and he's a cunning guy. And again, you know, as a defender of the faith, he's also a defender of something else that we don't know about. And it's again, like the plot gets really sticky here because you think this is the main guy who's looking to take all this stuff down, and he kind of knows the deal about Taylor. So it's a great, I don't know, again, I think it's a great plot moment. And in the end, they drag Taylor off, and he's like, "Why are you so afraid of me, Doctor? Why are you so afraid of me?" And obviously, you know, that truth will come at the climax of the film. So Taylor is then freed by Lucius, Zira's nephew. They all escape. Taylor gets guns, and, you know, they basically meet Cornelius, and they all get weapons and horses and provisions. And Taylor finally gets a gun, you know, equips himself well, and through a long trek, which is pretty uneventful, they end up at the seashore, which is this cave that Cornelius had talked about earlier in the trial where he had found these artifacts. So now, Taylor is kind of free, and no way is he going back to his captivity, as he even says. So he shaves also as well, and there's this scene of him shaving, and now we have the clean-shaven Chuck Heston, and it's a cool moment because Taylor's kind of coming back into his own as a quasi-civilized human being. But before they can go up and examine the caves, they've been followed by the apes from Ave City. They attack. Taylor is able to take Zaius hostage. They send all the rest of the apes behind the rocks, and Taylor is now chastising Zaius on his closed mind because Cornelius is telling him that there's evidence in the cave that kind of prove his theory. So Taylor tries to set up a deal where if they can prove what they're saying is true by the evidence in the cave, Zaius will let them off. And Taylor ostensibly is trying to help Cornelius and Zero since they've helped him to escape. Of course, Zaius agrees. Not that he has any intention of keeping his agreement, but he agrees because Zaius is a survivor. So we go into the cave, and Cornelius has this explanation where, you know, the first level, he finds evidence of a simian culture about the same time as the sacred scrolls were written. Another level down were even more primitive remains, but then at the third level were a whole bunch of artifacts that seemed to be made by, you know, a civilization that knew metallurgy and that were much more advanced. And so he doesn't understand how that can be if the more ancient civilization was the more advanced. And then there's also a human doll that's there. Zaius looks at the doll, and then, of course, Zaius' idea is that apes kept humans as pets, and who knows what all this junk is that you found. And then Heston looks at it all, and he knows everything. And there's this really poignant scene where he's like, you know, this, I don't say that this guy was someone I knew back on Earth, but he had all my weaknesses. And he pulls out a kind of a crushed set of eyeglasses and false teeth and an artificial heart. Kind of a poignant scene where, you know, this is sort of Heston's, these are his ancestors, I guess, in a way, you know, or his future progeny. It kind of gets taught up in the brain, depending on when this happened. Zaius still thinks that it's bullshit and that all this stuff can be, all the things that Heston has said can be explained away in another way. And then all of a sudden the doll is dropped and it talks. It's, you know, basically a talking doll. And Heston has this great line where he's like, Dr. Zaius, would an ape make a human doll that talks? Completely proving Cornelius' theme. But before anything happens, the shots from outside, and obviously the apes had snuck back up and they overpowered young Lucius, who was on guard duty. Then basically there's a little bit of a standoff because he takes Zaius hostage again, you know, so they come out ahead. The final sequence of the film, Taylor brings Zaius down, tells his sort of minions, I want a horse and water and food and ammunition for me and the female, and he ties up Zaius. Lucius says to Taylor, well, what if they don't give me what I want? And Taylor says, tell them I'll kill him. And Cornelius and Zero are like, no, Taylor, you can't. And Zaius says, ah, yes, he can. He's a born killer. Which begins the really great part, one of my favorite parts of this whole film, which is the confrontation between Zaius and Taylor here. Taylor ties up Zaius pretty tightly. You know, he's not comfortable. Cornelius and Zero kind of chide him. You're hurting him. And Taylor's basically like I was hurt. You led me around on a leash. Then he basically looks at Zaius and he's like, he's known all the time about human beings. He knows about man. You ask him, you know, he knows more than you think he does. Zaius says, I know all I need to know of man. And he gets Cornelius to read him a section of what the apes call the sacred scrolls. I'm not exactly sure what section. They do say it in the film, but I don't know which one. Anyway, and it's a devastating, devastating read. So I'm gonna quote it in full here, because this is the bookend to Heston earlier on in the film. Taylor, I should say. Earlier in the film, talking about, does man still make war against his brother? There's got to be something better than man. There's got to be something out there greater than we are, and his whole search for it. The scroll that is read is, and I quote, beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport, for lust, for greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, drive him back into his jungle lair, for he is the harbinger of death. And as he's reading it, the camera focuses on Taylor's, and his face falls, because, and you just know that he's taking it in, that he doesn't disagree with this, because he said it himself in the beginning of the film, that, you know, and it's sort of being brought home to him, like, this is who he is. This vaunted humanity that he's so proud of, this is who he is. And he's chiding the apes for being warlike and for leading him around on a leash. And yet they have this wisdom about his race that is quite devastating. And it's an amazing scene. Then Taylor gets what he gets, the horse and ammunition, and he says goodbye to all of the other apes, says goodbye to Cornelius, kisses Zero goodbye. And there's this nice moment where Kim Hunter kind of blushes and she's like, "You're so damned ugly." And they kiss, and you cut away to Cornelius, and he's like, his mouth blows a little bit because he's a little jealous. It's really cool. And then there's this last great back and forth between Taylor and Zaius. I'm going to read the quotes in their entirety because I think it's the hinge of this whole film and the thrust of it. So the first shot is from Zaius, and he says, "All my life, I've awaited your coming and dreaded it, like death itself." And then Taylor responds, "I've terrified you from the first, Doctor. I still do. You're afraid of me and you hate me. Why?" And so Zaius replies, "Because you're a man and you're right. I've always known about man. From the evidence, I believe his wisdom must go hand in hand with his idiocy. His emotions must rule his brain. He must be a warlike creature who gives battle to everything around him, even himself." So again, Taylor doesn't seem to be too spooked by this one, but it's as devastating as the scroll. I wonder if Serling wrote one of these. Maybe Serling wrote the scroll and this guy, the second screenwriter, wrote this one, because it seems like it's one after the other, they're saying the same thing. But again, it's a devastating delivery. It's basically telling Heston that what he believed in the beginning of the movie, you know, and he's been fighting for his supposed humanity throughout the whole movie, and yet, you know, the very notion is he's out there because he wants to transcend it. So it's just devastating. Taylor rides off with Nova. Zaius goes back on his word. Once they leave, destroys the cave, he's going to try Cornelius and Zero for heresy. And there's this great line where Zero's nephew Lucius is like, "What about the future?" And Zaius says that he just might have saved it for him. And then you have the last scene in this movie, and what a scene it is. It will be legendary long after I am gone, and it will be legendary as long as, you know, there are films. It starts with the camera. First, you follow Taylor and Nova on horseback, and some nice shots of the surrounding area and of the sea. They're riding along the shoreline. You know, you have Goldsmith's eerie score. You know, it doesn't seem very triumphant. You know, we're not being told by the music that our hero is won and the movie is over. Something's coming, and we don't know what it is, and it's very spooky. Eventually, there's a shot that starts where the camera's way in front of Taylor, pointing at him from high up. Pan slides over to the left, and we see some weird metal structure that looks man-made. It does not look like the rock that we've seen. It's this kind of metal-encrusted structure, and we have no idea what it is. But it slows Taylor down, and he kind of stops still on his horse. And then there's another similar shot, again, from the front, where it just shows Taylor, and then the camera again swings around to the left, and we see this sort of semicircle of spikes come into the camera's view. And in the middle of the spikes, down on the sand, we see Taylor. We shoot down on Taylor, and we get his whole speech, which, what an incredible position this human being has been put in, you know? And the speech is, quote, "Oh my God, I'm back, I'm home. All the time it was, we finally really did it. You maniacs, you blew it up. Ah, damn you. God damn you all to hell." Then the shot tracks to Nova, and she's mystified, so she looks up. The camera's then behind them, and it slowly widens out. And as it widens out, we see, buried up to her midsection, the encrusted ancient Statue of Liberty. There's no sound now. All you hear is the surf and the waves. And slowly we fade to black. And even when the credits come on, there's no music. There's just waves and ocean sounds. And as an audience, you're allowed to process that moment. There's not some rock band chiming in with the credits or some other crap. Like, you're given the chance to process this amazing moment that, you know, the whole film has been pointed towards. I know that people make fun of Heston and they rip on him in this moment, but I'm so on board with the film that I don't find this histrionic. I mean, I don't find it overacted. I mean, what is he supposed to do, you know? So I think if it was poorly acted, I think, you know, when he does his crazy lines, I think if they were really badly acted, I might not like them, but they're just emphatic. He was just an emphatic actor, and he gave it his all, man, and he inhabited the role and said the lines the way he thought the character was would say them in that moment. I'm completely behind him, and I love his performance. I think he not only gives a performance a physical power, you know, but a vocal power too with his voice. And I think he's a terrific actor. I mean, I've seen him do Shakespeare. He can hold down a really big movie. I mean, he's a very versatile actor, and I think for some reason, he gets slammed a lot. And, you know, not even talking about his political leanings later in his life, but I've always liked him, and I think he's amazing in this film and really anchors it, you know, with his presence. And that ends the film. Just some trivia for those who are interested. This film was followed up by four sequels. Beneath the Planet of the Apes came out in 1970, followed by Escape from the Planet of the Apes, then Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and then Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Then the year after Battle, they started a TV series simply called Planet of the Apes in 74. 75, they rebooted the TV series and made it an animated called Return to the Planet of the Apes. And then a long period of nothing, and then Tim Burton's remake in 2001, Planet of the Apes. And then the rebooted trilogy, which began with Rise of the Planet of the Apes in 2011, and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, 2014. And I think the third one may just be titled Planet of the Apes, which is going to come, I think, in 2016. So the Apes franchise is alive and kicking. The five movies that were made, you know, I was thinking about reviewing all of them, but the four sequels are really mostly of poor quality. I think Escape and Conquest are watchable, but Beneath and Battle are just, you know, abysmally boring. But you can go on Wikipedia, and they have fairly well-written synopses because the story is a cyclical one, and it's very cool how they crafted the five movies to tell sort of a cycled story. And really, the end of the last movie is sort of a setup for the first movie. Kind of a rare and interesting thing in film to kind of have that. So I encourage you, if you don't know much about these films or their plots and you're interested in this notion, to read them on Wikipedia first, and then if you want to see them, you know, please do. That is my review of Planet of the Apes. I hope that I may have touched on a few things that may bring this, for long-standing lovers of this film, I hope you enjoyed hearing me talk about what you probably already knew. For folks who didn't know about this movie or may have thought of it as kind of a schmaltzy, goofy film, I hope maybe, you know, I may have inspired you to go out and rent the film and give it a second look with a different eye, you know, than maybe you have in the past. So once again, my name is Jeff Palermo, and this is Sci-Fi on Screen, and thanks very much for listening.